Welcome to No Limits. I'm John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the Indiana Authors Awards. We're fortunate to have as our guest the national award winner, author Margaret McMullen, the regional award winner, author Helen Frost, and Emily Berger, the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John.
Good to have you here. Helen, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And Margaret, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, John.
It's good to have you here. Emily, could you talk a little bit about what the Indiana Authors Awards are, how they came to be? It's a relatively recent phenomenon.
Sure, yeah. So. It's relatively recent. This is our third year for the actual award. However, this has been a vision of Mr. Gene B. Glick's for some time, 10 or 15 years ago even. He, being a great fan of, obviously, Indiana and also a big passionate reader himself, had kind of thought about what he would like to do to honor the literary arts in Indiana and recognize Hoosier authors. And so within the last few years, the Library Foundation has been working with the Glick Fund, who supports this initiative and program throughout the state, to honor and recognize Indiana authors. And we're so fortunate that we have a great pool of honorees this year for our third annual year that we get to celebrate this weekend.
And in the interest of full disclosure, I probably ought to say that I'm on the awards panel, one of the judges who helps determine this. And it's both a privilege and a pleasure to do that. I'd like to talk, Margaret and Helen, a little bit about what this award means, the significance of having your work recognized. Helen, what has it meant to you?
It's just a huge honor, and it's the special thing about it is the committee. So thank you for your part in that. And all of the people that took the time to consider all the different nominees, the people who nominated us. I mean, it's all part of that community of literature in Indiana, which has been important to me for as long as I've lived here. So it's great.
Yeah. Margaret, what has it meant for
it's
you?
It's a huge honor. Huge. First of all, to be considered even was just among such great talent. And so thank you very much.
Well,
and also,
the point of the disclosure was to not hide anything from the audience, not to elicit thanks or anything like that.
It not only is a wonderful personal achievement for me, but it's also, it really spotlights books, the libraries, the librarians reading in Indiana. I really do think that this award ceremony itself is magnificent. And Emily and the Glicks have done such amazing work just on the details of arranging for this weekend. And also, I just think it's a cultural jewel in Indiana for you all to have, or for us rather, to have this kind of award ceremony. On another,
you
the
all
other
would
hand,
be a clue.
You
You're
all,
not from
I'm
here.
Sorry.
That's okay.
At least I didn't say y'all.
Yeah.
It also spotlights my own program, or our own program at the University of Evansville. We have a BFA program in creative writing, and I love that it brings a little attention to that, too.
I want to talk a little bit about what we look for.
Sure.
When we're trying to select these authors. Emily.
Yeah, well, it's actually a public nomination process. As John mentioned, we have an award panel who gathers around the table as these nominations are coming in. So anybody throughout the state or country, even for that matter, and I think that's what's great about the award, it's the reader and the fan who's making the nomination of these authors and saying, you know, I think this person would be a great fit for the award because of titles that they've written or contributions that they've made in promoting literature, whether their own work or the work of other authors throughout the state. And we have three categories. John, as you sort of mentioned, two of our winners with us today. The national author is judged based on their entire body of work. Our regional author is representative of the state of Indiana, and again, judged on their entire body of work. And then we have three emerging author finalists who are judged on up to two titles published within the last 10 years. And those folks are kind of new on the scene, and someone that we think, or the panel thinks, should be recognized for kind of this budding talent, and that more people should have an opportunity to read them and be aware of their work. And I should you know, backtrack a little bit too. When Mr. Glick was kind of envisioning this, I think when we think of Hoosier authors, we sort of harken back to like a James Whitcomb Riley era, or even like a Kurt Vonnegut. But in 1918, pardon me, the New York Times published an article that second to, I think, New York City, Indiana had the most booming author population of nationally recognized authors. And we think there are so many talents that we need to recognize today and just get the word out about that. And so that's really the purpose of the award, when Mr. Glick was thinking, like, how can we showcase all of this and make not just Hoosiers aware of this, but also people throughout the country? And so that's what we're trying to do by eliciting this public nomination process and then highlighting those authors.
We're talking about the Indiana Authors Award here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. You've got an event, Emily. I want to get that out this weekend, a series of events, really. Could we talk a little bit about that, with instructions about how people, if they do want to take part, can do so?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. We have a series of public programs, actually, Saturday, October 29th at Central Library, starting at 9:30 and wrapping up at 4:30. All of our workshops and programming is free and open to the public. You can always find more information at IndianaAuthorsAward.org, where you also find more information about Helen and Margaret and our fabulous emerging author finalists this year. That's has a series of programs. We've partnered with the library and the Writer Center of Indiana to bring some how to get published workshops. We have some information for different genres of writing, from poetry to romance fiction to graphic novels. So if you are someone who's wanting to maybe test your writing skills, or wants to dip your toe in the water, these are great workshops for you. And then we have some information on self-publishing, some exhibits, and you'll also have a chance to sit down with our Indiana Authors Award winners and finalists for a panel discussion and pose some questions to them.
Margaret and Helen, I'd like to talk a little bit about whether this award and this sort of support is significant at this particular time for writers. I mean, we've seen, obviously, my wife makes a joke that it was not a coincidence that the day I bought a Kindle is the day that Borders declared bankruptcy. But we've seen that at some level, the nature and the whole definition, really, of what book reading is and literature, in some ways, are in a revolutionary state right now. Is it significant at this kind of transitional period that there is this kind of support, Margaret?
Well, interesting that you mentioned this. One of my former students, Jane Friedman, is going to be giving the keynote presentation on Saturday at 9:30 about just this. She's like the expert now on new ways to write in this publishing world and how to kind of stay on top of everything that's going on. You were speaking before the show about tweeting or twittering, or I don't even have the terms right myself. I'm just so proud that I'm on Facebook. I think it does, to answer your question, it's a green light. It's a green light. These awards are huge for writers. First of all, any award is huge for writers. We take anything we can get, any excuse to keep on, because ultimately a writer is just alone in a room writing, working. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you really do have to develop some thick skin. You get a lot of rejections before you get an acceptance. And I think that's just a given. I personally don't think too much about, but when I'm writing, I don't think about, I just write sentences and write stories. So I'm not thinking about how it's going to be applicable to Kindle or anything like that. So I think in terms of books, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense. Maybe I should edit that thinking a little bit more to consider other ways. But this award is I don't know of any other state that does this. And I think it's really, really significant that Indiana has, you know, the backing of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation and the Glicks. I mean, it's really significant.
Mm-hmm. Helen, does the fact that the support comes at a transitional time in the way we view literature, is that of significance to you?
Yes, in fact, just this past few weeks, I've been going back and forth with the publishers and designers because they have. I'm a poet, and I think hard about how my books are going to look on the page. And with ebooks, the reader can adjust the font size, the length of the lines, and to some extent, that's okay. But you miss a lot with my books if you're not seeing them as they were written. So it's the same with audiobooks. You know, we faced these questions before, but right now it is a crucial time, especially because so many people are just switching their habits of where they buy books. You know, I was at a it was the Texas Library Association last spring sometime. I was in a session where two people were recommending what they thought were the best young adult books, and I was sitting beside someone who was listening as the speaker was recommending books. She was ordering them on her Kindle or whatever her reader was. But I thought, wow, that is a whole new world. I suspect that people are buying more books than they read. You know, that it's easy if you aren't concerned about your book budget, which some people apparently aren't, then you can download a lot of books very easily and quickly, and maybe it saves you a trip to the library or something. I don't know. I really hope that libraries don't get lost in this whole transition, as you call it. That's probably a good word. But
it's a neutral one.
Yeah.
Which is why I chose it.
I think my favorite thing about this award is that it does honor libraries, that part of the monetary award goes to support libraries, and that the authors are allowed to choose which libraries. So it's a way for us to be able to thank the people that have been supportive of us and our work.
We are talking about the Indiana Authors Award and really about reading and writing as ways we communicate here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Helen alluded to the fact that this change also has put libraries under some pressure. How are you coping, Emily, at the Indianapolis Public Library? I know you're attached to the foundation.
Sure. Well, yeah, I know too that within the Indianapolis Public Library system, we've had ebooks for a while now, but just recently we made the transition so that books are available on the Kindle platform, which they weren't previously. Mm-hmm. And I think the most recent statistic was that ebook circulation is up by, you know, 3 to 4 times what it was previously, even within the last month since making that. And I know the librarians have really focused from a staff training perspective on teaching patrons how to download and use that, whether that's, you know, your reader could be your computer or it could be your Nook or your Kindle or whatnot. So the staff is transitioning with that as well. And I think they're really embracing that. That's a new opportunity to work with the patrons on giving them access to books and materials, while recognizing still that there's a huge percentage of the population that doesn't have that technology and still will be using the books. And, you know, and even if they have access to it, might prefer that book in hand. But it requires more training.
Well,
and
as Helen has pointed out, there are going to be some books that really do not translate well to that medium, or some forms of writing. I would think, I just read David McCullough's book about Paris, The Greater Journey, and with all of the reproductions in there, I can't see that translating well to an e-reader at all. Is it going to change the way, though, that libraries function and structure? I mean, we obviously have gone through a massive renovation of the library here, and it's almost as if we're moving away from a bricks and mortar approach.
I think, you know, amongst the library world, and there's a lot of discussion about that, they're talking about what that means. Obviously, it opens up shelf space. But I think still the need for potentially for reader's advisory and for libraries to find their role in working with the patron to find, you know, the titles that they want to read, to refer them to good authors, to help them, you know, select research materials. I don't think that will change. It's just the format. And I think libraries have to be ready to evolve in that manner.
We are talking about the state of literature here in Indiana. The spear for this is the Indiana Authors Award. Our guests are Margaret McMullen, Indiana author, Helen Frost, also an Indiana author, and Emily Berger, the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking about the Indiana Authors Award today, and our guests are author Margaret McMullen, author Helen Frost, and Emily Berger of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. We're talking, obviously, the news hook here is that the Authors Awards are announced on Saturday, and we've got a dinner that evening and events that we have discussed. I'd like to talk a little bit now about why people write, to get inside that process. Margaret, I'm going to start with you. Why do you write, and when did you start to think this was the way you wanted to spend your life?
My goodness, that's a huge question. And I'm glad I have had a chance to think about that a little, because I hope to address that in my remarks on Saturday night. But it is such a question, and I think it changes every day that you write. I really do. Every project you have, I think the answer to that question changes, because sometimes I do think you write to remember people or things, and I think sometimes you also write to forget. And I think you also write to kind of live out loud and to just connect with people, to tell a story that you're dying to tell. And everything that I write, I really, I spend so much time with it, it has to matter to me personally. Mm-hmm. So I write things that absolutely keep me up at night, and that, you know, I feel urgent. I feel an urgency to get the story out for whatever reason. I was born in Newton, Mississippi, mm-hmm. which is near Chunky.
Okay.
Help you figure that out.
I was going to say.
And when we moved up to the suburbs of Chicago when I was about 9 years old, I had this accent that was not very popular in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s. It was a thick Southern accent, mm-hmm. and I got picked on a lot. So I just stopped talking. And by doing that, I think that put me in the habit of writing a journal. It was just nothing really special, but I just got in this habit I absolutely could not shake. So I don't feel right if I haven't written something during the day. And it's like, you know, Flannery O'Connor wrote about it in Habit of Being. You're in this habit of writing, and it's like brushing your teeth. You know, you don't feel right if you don't do it.
Well, what prompted you to start the journal?
Oh, I felt very sorry for myself. Yeah. It was cold in Chicago. You know, I miss magnolia trees and my cat and all my friends and my family in Mississippi. It was just the most pathetic, whiny kind of thing that I wrote about. But again, I mean, it was just awful.
Now, how much, and I'm going to say, like, your most recent book, Sources of Light.
Yes.
Draws on some of, at least some of the experiences from the mm-hmm. region you were talking about. I don't want to give too much away. I'd rather hear that in your words, which is why I'm being somewhat elliptical here in my description mm-hmm. of it. How do you conceive of, you know, when you start writing a book, what is it that prompts you and says, this is, where does it start? Where does the process start for you?
I think every project, I'm looking at Helen because I know she feels this way too, but every project starts differently, I think. I always wanted to write about the 60s in Mississippi, but it has been so done, especially all the racial tensions there. And I knew that I had limited knowledge, really, because I was so young. But I wanted to write about 1962, for instance, which I think was relevant because
it was sort of that time right before the real violence burst open. It was just like this, you could feel, I remember feeling it. There was, because I remember moving and not feeling it anymore. And cicadas play a big part in the background of it. And to me, that was sort of a metaphor of all that tension and sort of the buzz, literally, that I felt. And I kind of backed into it, really. I knew that I wanted my protagonist, Samantha, to be older than I was in 1962. So she was 14. My son happens to be 14 years old as well. And my son also was learning to take pictures. He was interested in photography. My husband is a wonderful photographer. So there was, at our dinner table, there was a lot of talk about photography, and that kind of seeped into everything. And I kept thinking, photography, the 1960s, a period of black and white, racial tensions. All of this sort of feeds into how the books begin to emerge. And that gives you a little taste of Sources of Light. But inevitably, Samantha and her mother, a widower, moved back to Jackson, Mississippi, in the beginnings of what are to be really violent times.
We are talking about the state of Indiana literature here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Helen, I'm going to ask you basically the same question. What prompts you to write? And then I'm going to talk about one of your books and maybe ask you to talk a little bit about the genesis of that.
Okay. You know, I've always written. I've just come back from a school visit and spending a couple of days talking to high school students. This is something they want to know. And I think essentially they want to know, you know, was I a writer at their age? And to them, being a writer probably means having books published. And for me, publication was a long way in the future, and I wasn't really thinking about it when I was in high school. But from the time before I could hold a pencil, I mean, this is a funny memory that I have of taking big leaves and pounding them with rocks to make it look like letters. It's so primal, you know, that I don't know, it was a friend or a sister or someone, we were like giving these leaves back and forth to each other with these marks on them. And then when I could hold a pencil, I would scribble to make it, to imitate writing. So for me, you know, going to school and learning how to actually read and write was an exciting time. And I remember in second grade writing my book of poems on a little piece of construction paper and writing these little rhyming things on pages and stapling it together and giving it to someone for Christmas. You know, it was always just part of who I was. And then as I went into high school, college, my adult life, I just, you know, became more knowledgeable and eventually, I hope, more sophisticated about what I was doing and how the life of a writer fit in with other things that were important in my life. So there's a famous quote by William Stafford when people say, you know, when did you become a writer? And he says, what I want to know is when did everyone else stop? And that's how I feel about it. You know, I never stopped.
Could we talk a little bit about the genesis, say, of Keisha's House? And you write the description, the boiled down phrase we use is that they're novels and poems.
Yeah, I like that better than novels in verse. That's the more common expression, but I call them novels and poems.
Novels and poems. Could you talk a little bit about what that is and really how you start the process then of deciding what you want to do?
I mean, the reason I say novels and poems is pretty much just that my training was in poetry, and I haven't given that up and gone over to writing for children and teens. I've carried all of what I know about both those things. You know, I've always loved children. I've always loved language. And the novels in poems for children and young adults, which is, you know, the thing I'm doing primarily right now, gives me a chance to combine all those different things. So the process for me is just messing around on paper for a while and seeing, you know, the form of the book is usually important. The structure of the book usually has something to do with the way the book develops. You asked about Keisha's House. That is a a book that's written in very traditional form, sestinas and sonnets, and both of those forms are very architectural. I'm, you know, creating a space on the page, they're both kind of blocky forms. You know, it's interesting just the way they look on a page, which is different from some of my more recent work. To me, it's just the structure of the book and the structure of each page has to do with the development of the story itself. And it's always, like Margaret was saying, it's always mysterious. I'm never sure how that's going to happen or how it's happening at the moment. Sometimes it can be frightening. You know, you don't know where you're going and you feel like, you know, I'm supposed to know what I'm doing and I don't, you know. But it does eventually all come together.
Well, let me ask this. We're talking about the Indiana Authors Award mm-hmm. and the state of literature here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Question I want to ask is, where does the satisfaction come from in writing? I mean, both of you have alluded to the fact that it can be a somewhat lonesome occupation in that you're, you know, cloistered by yourself to some degree, having to put the words down on the page. What makes it meaningful for you? What parts does it draw upon, Margaret?
Well, it used to be that when I was writing full stories in high school, I had great satisfaction with going to my parents and reading it out loud and seeing if they would cry. And if they cried, I was so happy. And you know, it's so funny. They were my first audience, but, you know, I still go to them. Now the goal is to make them laugh. So there is that satisfaction you get when you see audience response, which is something. But actually, I think there's another satisfaction, you know, that's maybe minor, but to me it's not. I mean, I really love sentences. When I write a sentence and it's good, I'm good.
And
I'm good to go.
How do you define what makes a good sentence?
I'm a real big fan of complete sentences with subjects and verbs. Uh-huh. My students make fun of me for this, but you know, even on tests, I want a complete sentence. And so there's just the basic craft of a sentence. There's just that. And then there's a beautiful sentence where you just know it rings true. Like, you know, Helen was talking about, you don't know if things are all going to come together, but, you know, sometimes they don't. And so there is that. There is that manuscript in the desk where things didn't quite come together. But, you know, when you can make connections, unlikely connections for the reader and take them through an experience that might not be so pleasant, but still you've created it and crafted it into an art form, you know it when it happens. And you have to do a little jig.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess I should ask, given the, you know, the theme here, the strength of the sentence and all of that, a lot of the newer forms of communication, texting, tweeting, frankly, which we are encouraged.
I'm going to just jump in. That's a form of communication of this generation. And, you know, there are books out there all like in tweets and in texts. And, I probably won't read them and I doubt that I'll write like that, but, you know, for me, there's a flip side to it, too. There are still readers out there who appreciate a good story and good sentences. So those, to me, are the people I'm writing for them.
And that audience. Helen, where do your satisfactions come from?
A lot of what Margaret was saying, that moment when you've been struggling, like I said, I kind of start with making a big mess. And then at some point when you sort of feel like you can hold something in your hand and say, oh, you know, I've got something here. And there's a lot of work beyond that to polish it up. And I want to mention editors, too. You know, once you have finished with it and offer it into the hands of a trusted editor, then from there, it becomes something that is, I find it beautiful. The process is beautiful. And of course, when you see a reader responding to it, I have one reader, she's in her 20s now, but when she was maybe 17, she loved my book called The Braid. That was just like every time I saw her, she would talk to me about this book. And when she got a little older, she went on a trip to Iceland and she had to pack her suitcase really tightly. And her mom was trying to say, oh, you know, do you really need all these things? And she wouldn't take out the braid. You know, that had to go with her. It was, you know, that was so touching to me to hear that, that something that I had said was important to her enough that she wanted to keep it with her. And for each one of my books, I've heard something like that from different students and different kids. And even my most recent book, I had the first letter I had about it was the book was called Hidden. And I got this letter that said, Dear Helen Frost, will you please hurry up and write a sequel because I'm almost finished with Hidden.
Wow.
It's like, get on it, you know.
Well, and how do you define your relationship with your readers then, your audience? That's got to be, I say this, you know, and again, in sort of disclosure, I was a newspaper columnist for years, and it never ceased to amaze me that people would come up to me on the street mm-hmm. because my photo would run above the column in the newspaper and just start a conversation mm-hmm. as if they, you know, not realizing that because they knew what I thought, I wouldn't necessarily know what they thought. Mm-hmm. Both of you probably have had a similar experience where because people have read your work and mm-hmm. all of that, they assume a knowledge of you. Mm-hmm. Helen, you're nodding your head emphatically here.
Yeah, so. It's absolutely true that people know you better than you know them. And you know, maybe better than they should know you.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm sure that's true.
Yeah. I was just thinking, people keep, you know, I wrote a book called How I Found the Strong, set during the Civil War, and it came out, I think, in 2004. And people keep telling me their Civil War stories. And, you know, as interesting as those stories are, I thank you. But, you know, I think that the assumption is you're going to write another one, right? And I'm like, I don't think so. I'm going to kind of move on. But to answer that question, Helen and I both write for young adults and mm-hmm. adults. And we were talking about this earlier this morning. There's a lot more reader response with young adults. We get to know our readers, I think, probably more than we know our adult audience. And maybe that's because we do so many school visits. Mm-hmm. And we literally, they ask these very specific questions, sometimes very personal, but sometimes.
Such,
you know,
as what sort of questions?
Oh, they want to know how much you weigh, how old you are, how much you make.
Those are, yeah, I guess that is
part
pretty
of the
personal.
Panel
yeah.
On Saturday.
We are
that level.
We are talking about the state of literature here in the state of Indiana. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Joan, welcome to the program. Joan?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Your question,
How
please.
How are you?
Doing well. Your question,
yes,
please.
My question is, I self-publish my own books. Mm-hmm. And I have two books that I've written, and they do pretty well with the kids or the young adults that have read them. Even adults like it. And I have a hard time right now marketing my books to the correct audience. So I was just calling to see how I can do that.
Well, we will see if we can get an answer for you, at least the start of an answer. Thank you for the call and the question. How do we get started marketing books? I mean, Emily, I think that probably would be best directed to you since
sure.
the library buys a lot of yeah. books. So.
Well, I think that's even a trend that before I worked for the Library Foundation, I was in the programming department at the Indianapolis Public Library, and we would get calls from a lot of authors who self-publish, which is becoming an increasingly popular way to publish a book, especially because, you know, within the traditional publishing industry, I think there's a lot more selectivity than there ever has been before because it's a little bit of a leaner period of time. And a lot of people, I think, initially think of the library as the best place to go. And I would recommend, you know, grassroots marketing of self-published titles to be the best route. But local independent booksellers or even some of the box stores like Barnes & Noble and things would be willing to carry those titles. But folks who have blogs, we've seen, you know, I think of John Green. He's published a lot of young adult titles, and he has a fabulous blog. I would kind of look to some great examples of other authors to see how they're doing that.
We are talking about the state of literature here in Indiana as we head up to the announcements of the Indiana Authors Awards this Saturday. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm John Kroll. We're talking with author Margaret McMillan, author Helen Frost, and Emily Berger of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the state of literature in Indiana as we head into the Indiana Authors Award festivities this weekend. Our guests are Margaret McMillan, who is an Indiana author, Helen Frost, also an Indiana author, and Emily Berger of the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation. Before we headed to the break, Emily, you were talking really about how self-published authors might be able to find their way to readers.
Sure. And Margaret, I think at the break, brought up a good point, too. I'll let her reference that. But I would be remiss if I didn't promote that there are some self-publishing workshops at Saturday's programming, and they're going to talk a little bit about marketing your titles at that point in time, as well, you know, in reference to Joan's question. A part of the Indie Author Fair includes book sales and signings with our authors. And so Margaret, Helen, and our emerging author finalists will be there in conjunction with about 40 other Hoosier authors, some of whom are self-published and some who've gone through more traditional channels to publish their books. And I think they would be a great reference point, too, if you just wanted to come and talk to those folks and see what they've done and where they've had some of that success as well.
Margaret, you were going to say something.
Well, yeah, I just, because I know there are so many people who are interested in self-publishing or who are self-publishing. And what I've seen people do is they go to these conferences, whether or not they're free or not, I'm not sure, but they make these connections with other writers and with editors, often agents. But basically, they do, they're very proactive, they get their work out there. And, you know, we were talking about how when we do the actual work, we're alone in the room, but the promotion aspect of it is a whole different level of energy. And, you know, the more you can get out, the better. And, of course, there is also the internet getting out, you know, the social media, which I think is crucial for someone who's self-publishing.
We've gotten a tweet with a question saying, do you find writing groups to be helpful? How can I find a good local one? And what are the relative merits of pursuing an MFA? Mm. Margaret McMillan, I'll throw that one back to you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, I teach in the Department of Creative Writing at the University of Evansville in Evansville, Indiana, and we are one of the oldest programs in the country to offer a Bachelor of Fine Arts in undergraduate creative writing. So we're really proud of that. And one of the things that we talk a lot about is, of course, the craft of writing, which is essential, but also what it means to be a professional writer. We talk about internship opportunities in publishing. We talk about going to conferences and getting into contests and submitting your work, basically taking yourself seriously as a writer. We introduce our students to agents and editors and other writers and program directors. It really is a personal decision whether or not you decide to pursue a graduate degree in writing, the Master of Fine Arts, the MFA. And now there's a PhD, which throws another wrinkle or another moment for deciding. So most of the people who teach have either an MFA or a PhD in creative writing. So if you want to teach at the university level, that's the degree to go after, or, you know, in literature, PhD in literature. And teaching is wonderful because you get to talk, you do what you love. You talk about writing and literature, and you're around excited students and other colleagues who are interested in writing and literature. So, you know, it provides you with a world and in an instant atmosphere, and it gives you the summers off so you have time to write. So that's, you know, all a part of that decision making.
And is it important in other ways? I mean, I remember when my book came out about closing in on 10 years ago, I read this really sobering statistic from the Authors Guild saying that there were 600,000 published authors in the United States and Canada, and only 3,000 of them didn't have day jobs. That basically you're not going to sustain yourself simply by writing. Yeah. does that sort of academic structure that you're talking about provide the wherewithal for you to live while you do your writing?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because, you know, it's also difficult to get a teaching job now. Mm-hmm. But that does provide you with some kind of expertise. You can teach, and people need teachers. There's the backlash now, too, of MFA. So many MFA programs are, you know, there's so many programs out there, and now we're seeing so many kinds of MFA stories and books. I mean, they just sort of reek of classroom work. Mm-hmm. They're structurally, they're very sound, but, you know, they may lack some backbone or soul, for instance. You know, if a person is not dying to go to a graduate program, I always say, just, you know, don't do it. Don't just sit there and waste away 4 years or 3 years or 2 years. You really want to be hungry to do it because it buys you time to write your first book, and that's what you really want to do. And hopefully it's a really good book.
We are talking about the state of literature here in Indiana. Helen Frost, yes.
Yeah, I just had one thing to add about that. She asked also about writers' groups, and I think that is important to find other people, especially when you're beginning, other people to whom writing is important. And here in Indiana, the Writers' Center of Indiana is a great resource. It's based in Indianapolis, but it really serves the whole state. So find that online or join. You know, that's another thing, is to support the groups that support you.
And they have a great new director, Barbara Shoup,
yes.
Wonderful person, and
yeah.
She's just so friendly and so inviting.
Yes.
That is, you know, we got to work at being kind to ourselves as writers. We take a lot of, again, rejection. So to find a group that's supportive, I think, is helpful.
We are talking about the state of literature here in Indiana. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Kevin, welcome to the program. He had a question, if I understand it. He wanted you to talk a little bit more about the starting point for your work. What goes into when you first sit down specifically with one of your novels, since you're both novelists and working different formats, how you get started and really how that process works for you. Helen.
Yeah, I start hearing voices. It's when I get a sense of a voice and I start writing in the voice that I hear. Almost all of my work is in first person, which is unusual, I think, and possibly inadvisable. But that's how it works for me, that I start getting a sense of how someone speaks. Sometimes it's historical, and then I also do a lot of research. But basically, it's putting time and place and people together. And as I said, it's not always the same. I think actually Margaret was the one who said that. But each book has a different genesis and a different process. And it's just a matter of keeping at it, you know, just spending the time writing and working and seeing what you have and recognizing that the starting point of your writing will probably not be the place that you open to on page one. You know, there's a lot of just writing into it to find out what you're doing. Something like that.
It starts with a voice with you, Margaret. Does it start with a character
starts with a character and a time and a story that I know I want to write. And again, it's all different. And then if I research well enough and I keep writing about that person, then when I hear the voice and I'm dreaming in that voice, I know this is sounding so wiggy, but that's when I know. It's sort of like, you know, you've learned French or German or whatever foreign language. If you start dreaming in that, it's like that. You know, you know you're on the right track if you really even start talking like your characters. I mean, it sounds disturbing, I know. But because I think William Blake heard voices, too. And
and originally, didn't they? They would refer to, I think Norman Mailer did a book of essays called The Spooky Art. and in the Middle Ages, it was considered a dark art to some degree.
Yeah.
So how do you guys, since you obviously take the whole notion of literature as a responsibility seriously, a sense of connection with the audience, how do you feel about the sort of the assembly line authors out there? I hesitate, but the people who sort of retell the same story over and over again. I'm not going to put Emily because I'm guessing that they move a fair number of John Grisham books in and out of the library. But as authors yourself, I mean, how do you respond to that and the fact that, you know, I mean, is that art or is it merely commerce? Helen, you're both sort of avoiding commenting there.
To me, I don't care. You know, it's something really different from what I do. It would almost be like, how do I feel like assembly line somebody that makes living room furniture or something? You know, I might enjoy it. I don't read books that's a different kind of book than I write and a different kind of book than I read. But
what do you read?
What do I read?
Yeah, what kinds of books do you read?
You know, so much these days I'm reading books that other writer friends send me, and I have so many different friends. So I read a lot of poetry by adults and novels and books of poetry for children. I read books that are recommended by people that I respect, my sister. I just finished a wonderful book called Peace Like a River. Do you know that book, Margaret? Mm-hmm. I should know the author. It's Leif Enger or something like that, published about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But just this gorgeous sentence-level writing and just a remarkable plot. And I thought, oh, you know, I should read books published for adults more often because I really am an adult. You know, I'm the audience for that book. And it was just so beautifully constructed and a page turner at the same time that it was just this gorgeous, you know, writing. And so, you know, when I find a book like that, and I do have people who I respect who suggest books to me, so I pay attention. In terms of people writing books that I don't read, you know, why should I care? It doesn't, doesn't hurt me any. And different people read different things. And that's true for teenagers as well as for adults. So I think sort of aside on this, I think the idea that young adult literature is a genre in itself is sort of amusing because why would we expect teenagers to read one particular kind of books any more than we would expect older people to do that, you know?
Yeah, they have their own tastes and their own ideas, and they're almost like real people that way.
Right? Yeah.
Yes. Margaret, how do you feel about the assembly line novelists, and then what do you read?
Yeah, I remember there was a man from China in my graduate school workshop who got sort of angry at the hoity-toity attitude among some of his classmates, and basically just he didn't say anything for the semester, and then at the end, the last day, he said, "There are many flowers in the garden of literature," which humbled everybody in the room. You know, everyone, a story is a story. There are people who want to read Grisham. There are people who want to read whatever. I think where our attitude, too, it should be if it's making the publishing company money, then it allows the publishing company to publish other things, you know, that may not make a lot of money. There is that argument as well. But I actually try to read every now and then an assembly line kind of book because I like to know how to write a page turner, how to keep the plot going, and I think Grisham, for instance, is one who have figured out that formula.
Well, and at some level, I know that the argument, obviously, one of the big predictors for having young people develop the habit of reading is seeing their parents read, and it really doesn't matter whether, you know, it's the Funnies or an assembly line novel or Ulysses. It's just the simple act of reading. Now, what do you read, Margaret?
Well, right now I'm reading a ton of Hungarian history.
Why pray tell?
Working on a book. I don't know why I fell into this, but I'm writing about, I do know why. I'm writing a lot of historical stories, but one in particular, I spent a semester on a Fulbright at the University of Pécs, teaching there in Pécs, Hungary. And it's where my mother's family was originally from, but she actually never really knew about it. So I'm studying all of these things that neither she nor I ever knew, and it's interesting. I'm telling my mother about her own family history. So it's a fun project actually for both of us, but it's sort of bittersweet because of the people that she never knew existed in her life. But it's a really interesting project.
When do you expect to finish it?
I have no idea.
So we should be looking for it next week then, no. I guess not. Helen, what are you working on these days?
That's always a question that I want to educate people about how to ask that question. A better way of asking that to authors is to say, are you at a point in your writing where you can tell us what you're working on? Because for usually 6-8 months to a year, I'm not able to really talk about it. I'm just at a point now where I think I can say that the book I'm working on will be finished. So I'll just say a little bit about it. It's I'm from Fort Wayne, and the year 1812, there was a siege of the fort there, which I find a really profoundly interesting moment in history. So I've immersed myself in the Miami language, the history of the Miami group and the people who were at the fort at the time, and it's a novel for fairly young children that I hope will be read by kids when they're learning about state and local history, and I expect that to be finished in a few months and published probably in 2013.
Emily, in the very little time we've got left, can you talk a little bit about where people should go to find information about this weekend's festivities?
Sure. It's IndianaAuthorsAward.org. That's our website for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award program, and it has all the details about the workshops, the participating authors, you know, directions on how to get to Central Library. And like I said, it's free and open to the public, so anytime 9:30 to 4:30 this Saturday, we hope to see folks there.
We have been talking with author Margaret McMullen, author Helen Frost, and Emily Berger, the Indianapolis Public Library Foundation, about the state of literature here in Indiana. Margaret, it's been a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure it is to talk with you.
Helen, enjoyed talking with you very much.
You too. Thanks so much.
And Emily, it's always a pleasure.
Thanks, John.
We will be back next week when we talk about animal welfare and pet overpopulation. We will be doing this at our new time, 1 p.m., on Thursday. Please join us then. I'll look forward to talking with you then. I am John Kroll. See you next week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator Melissa Davis. Technical producer Jeanette Rhodes and board engineer Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.